Hi, my name is Andre Gonoella. I am being joined by my co-host, Andrea Ochoa. We are the Brain Bag Podcast. We're delighted to welcome back Jonna Mendez to talk about her new book, In True Face. We talked to her about 3 years ago. We had a great conversation, and we're excited for an even better conversation today. Jonna is a former chief of disguise in the CIA's Office of Technical Service, and she's often compared to Q in the James Bond movies and the Ian Fleming novels. Jonna was also a specialist in clandestine photography and spent about 27 years in the CIA, earning the CIA's Intelligence Commendation Medal, including operational disguise responsibilities in some of the most hostile theaters of the Cold War, from Havana to Beijing to Moscow, and ultimately, and I'm sure she'll talk about this in a little bit, a famous meeting in the Oval Office with President Bush the Senior. She currently authors a ton of great books, lectures, and gives a lot of talks. And with her late husband, Antonio Mendez, she authored Spy Dust, a true story of espionage and romance, Argo and the Moscow Rules. And her latest book, as I mentioned, is In True Face, talking about her career as a female operations officer in the CIA. It is out now. It's probably front and center in so many great bookstores that you might have seen. But I am so delighted and honored to have Jonna back on the podcast.
It's an honor to be back here. I can't believe it was 3 years ago when we last spoke.
Yeah, definitely. So, Jonna, in summary, can you tell us a bit more about your role as the CIA's chief of disguise?
Yeah, I was part of a larger office called the Office of Technical Service. And when we talk about Q, that office was the Q because we had such a range of capabilities and people. We were engineers, electrical, mechanical engineers. We were physicists, chemists, battery specialists, and then people who specialized in things you never dream of for a career. Ink was one. Hot air balloons was one. Just bits and pieces of every technical thing you could imagine. We had an office that did nothing but audio installations. We had an office that did mostly secret writing, micro dots, that kind of thing. I mean, it was just broad and it was deep. We could do almost anything. And sometimes that's exactly what we did.
Especially during that time, how were these methods really crucial to intelligence gathering activities? I mean, we can talk a little bit further in this interview about how things have changed since then, since you were serving, which I'm sure it's a plenty. But at the time, how would you say, operations and case officers used these capabilities to be able to do the work that they do?
Back when I started in the 60s, I left in the 90s, up through the end of the 80s, I would say the CIA was basically in front of commercial technology. We had needs for things that didn't exist. Take batteries, for instance. Everything, it seems like everything that we made, except for disguise, was powered by batteries. And most of the things that we made, we do whatever we're doing with them, and we'd never have a chance to go back and change the batteries. If you put an audio, a wood block underneath a desk or a conference room table or in the woodwork or wherever you're going to put it, that's a one time. You don't get to go back and replace them. So what we needed in that instance was smaller, more powerful, more longer lasting, tinier batteries for our equipment. And that in itself generated a whole new technical line of work that kind of spilled out into the commercial world. And it was the great grandfather of what's in your phone and what's in the hearing aids and what's in your watch. And so we were pushing technology at that time. Our officers would come in and give us a problem and say, I'm not sure how to solve that. We don't have anything on the shelves right now that can fix that or implement that. And our job was basically to solve that problem. So we were inventing stuff right and left. Things like bubble memory, we got into way before it was before it was out there. Things like disguise, we were sort of mimicking Hollywood for a long time. But then what we needed surpassed what Hollywood was capable of. And so off we went to build something better and knocked their socks off when they saw what we made. So does that answer the question that a lot of it was just because we needed it?
Right.
Because operations required this stuff.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of innovation really depends on that. And I think, you know, how was the CIA able to recruit the individuals that were able to have these great minds to develop that? That's insane. And I'm sure that's something that you're trying to accomplish as well with, you know, telling your story here.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of many other places like the CIA, where if you were a young technical officer, on the one hand, we had trouble recruiting them because we couldn't really tell them what they were going to be doing. And we didn't pay them a whole lot because we were a government office and you weren't ever going to get rich ever working for the CIA. Out in private industry, they could make a lot more money and they knew what they'd be doing. But we would tell them, and we weren't lying, we'd say, you will be on the cutting edge. I mean, you'll be heading into some frontiers that haven't been explored yet. And that pulled in a lot of the people that we wanted. People who liked that kind of a challenge. We had hugely innovative technical people at our disposal. Some of them were so, some of them were almost strange. You've met people like this, people who are so focused and so, I want to say narrow. I don't mean this in any disparaging way, but who just think way out there. It's hard to stay with them. You might use genius every once in a while here. Can I give you an example?
Absolutely.
our battery, the man who headed our battery department, George was just this free spirit. He had, way before it was cool, he had really long blonde hair. And when he walked down the hall, it kind of looked like there was a wind. He wore kind of mismatched clothes, stripes and checks, kind of white socks, and black sandals. Anyway, you'd see George and you'd think, do you have a mirror? You would think that. He was a very nice guy. He was just, he couldn't have been more pleasant to be around. We couldn't keep him in his office because he kept getting security violations because he couldn't remember that at the end of the day, you have to put all your stuff in a burn bag and then take it to a chute and drop it down the chute. So he got violations. So we ended up moving him into a vault. He lived in a vault.
With windows?
No. All he had to do was close the door when he left for the day, and he wouldn't get security violations. That was the George that I knew. I found out like 3 or 4 years ago that they've set up a new school at CIA. There are only four in this whole huge organization. There are four schools of excellence. And the Science and Technology School of Excellence is named after George. So George, you know, you were something. He was part of the team that fixed the Hubble telescope, among other things.
Made a lasting impression, it seems.
Yeah, we had great people.
So, you know, Jonna, I want to sort of ask you now about, you have this alternate career as a photographer, incredible photos. How do you sort of apply those photography skills to the art of disguise? Like how do you sort of compare the two, I guess?
I think they were kind of, to me, they were apples and oranges. It was just almost a whimsical career decision in the middle of my career where I just took a hard right. And I had a reason. I've been doing photo operations with good success. It was something I was interested in and I was good at it. And that's how I got out of the secretarial thing and got into the professional ranks. That's how I got overseas. That's how I got out. I got out of the dark room and onto the street and working with assets. It was going great. And then I went to the Middle East. Actually, we call it the subcontinent, for a summer, and just fell in love with where I was. And when I went back to headquarters, I said I would like an assignment out there. And I said, well, there isn't anything coming up for photo. Only thing coming up like within the next 2 years is a disguise job. So I said, okay, train me. I can do, I'm pretty sure. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking cutting wigs and mustaches, how hard can that be? oh, it's hard. It's not wigs and mustaches. It's all this other stuff. So I was presuming that it would be a cakewalk, and it was not. It was just a decision that I made to veer off in another direction that I think I'm lucky it didn't kill my career. Do you know what I mean? It was not a smart career decision, but it worked out just fine.
I think for many of us, you know, who are experiencing that and want to pivot to something completely new, one of the biggest challenges is trying to convince others to have faith in you to take that step. How did you go to these supervisor positions and be like, I want to train in this? Give me the chance and opportunity, even though I've never done this before.
There's a name that keeps coming up whenever I do these talks, and I do a lot of these talks, and that's Tony Mendez. Because when I was making that decision, Tony Mendez was my career management officer back at headquarters. And he was really good at that. He was good at almost everything he did. He was the one that said, there is a disguise job. Now, he had been working with disguise and then the larger element that disguise was part of. So he was very familiar with all of that. And he knew that I could make that. He knew that I could transition. He knew that I could do that work. He just knew it. So I had a friendly face who was helping me to get where I wanted. Not everybody, you know, when you need it, you look around and you hope you have a friendly face. I was lucky with bosses through my career, with a few exceptions. I put them in the book. I named them in the book. Mostly, I had a lot of support. And that was a big deal.
It always is. I think just to have that mentorship role, especially now, you know, it's good having someone that has faith in you.
You know, when I was a secretary, I worked my way up to the top job in this queue office. It was about 1,000 people, and I worked for the director. And I was bored. But there were two things. I had worked for a chief of station overseas whose secretary was, oh, so mean. She was just awful to the other secretaries. And I remember thinking, if I ever get into a job of responsibility, I would go out of my way not to emulate her. And when I worked for the director of that office that I was in, the Q office, I went out of my way to be helpful, to direct people who needed to see the boss, who I just did that. I made a lot of friends when I was in that job. Not for any other reason. I just made a lot of friends, and they helped me through my career. I kept bumping into them. Oh, and here's one, and there's one over there. And that was luck and goodwill.
Definitely. And, you know, Jonna, I'm really curious because, I mean, I feel like, and I'm saying this as a guy, but I feel like national security has often been this like very male heavy field, particularly so in the 60s and the 70s. And I was just really curious and like, how did you navigate that as a woman? How did you navigate this very, I mean, white male heavy field, you know, back then? Like, I mean, what were some of the key challenges and how did you sort of work through those?
The big challenge was, I mean, there's work and there's work. I didn't want to be a secretary. They talked me into staying. They said, okay, you can do the photo thing. And then overseas, I was in the dark rooms doing photo work, no longer a secretary, but that wasn't the job I wanted either. I wanted to be out on the streets. I wanted to be the one meeting with the foreigners who are risking their lives to work with us and providing the intelligence that goes back to the White House and all of this stuff. I always wanted that part of the work, and that is the piece of it that the guys don't want to give up. They still don't want to give it up today. They have 1,000 reasons why you can't do that job as a woman. You want them alphabetically or chronologically? The first big one was they said, men aren't going to listen to women. I mean, they're taking huge risks. They've got families and kids and dogs. They're worried about terrorism. They're worried about the security of their country. And you're going to protect them? They're not going to listen to you. You're just a woman. I said, can I say bullshit on your show? I said, bullshit.
You absolutely can.
Okay. Then they said, so you're in the Middle East. In the Middle East, women have absolutely no value, less than no value. So what if you get a Middle Eastern dye? What are you going to do? I said, I'm going to do a better job than you do. I'm going to tell him, because I'm a woman, because he knows that I'm more interested in protecting family and safety and all of that than you guys are. You want to teach him how to work the keyboard of this thing. I'll teach him how to work the keyboard. And then I'll teach him again to make sure he's got it. And then I'll ask about his family. And I'll ask about his kids. And I'll ask about his concerns. And does he need medicine for his little boy who's sick? And he's gonna like me a lot when I walk out the door. There's a story in the book. One of the first people I trained, it was in secret writing. And in a country I couldn't go to, I'm training his relative who could go there. The relative trained him. The relative said, this woman trained me. She came from Washington, D.C. just to train me. Her name is Jane, the name I used. And so you got to do a good job here. So the first secret message that comes in, and I'm developing it in this tray and I'm sloshing it around, it's coming up. And it says to Jane, you're not supposed to do that. Every Christmas, this guy that I never met and couldn't go to his country sent me a Christmas card. And he made it. It was a secret Christmas card done in secret writing. And he drew a Christmas tree. Merry Christmas, Jane.
Wow.
It kind of made the point. I would say to the guys, you guys ever get a Christmas card from someone you trained?
No, seriously. I did read that part in the book. You really honed in on the soft skills that I think women have strengthened in being able to establish that trust in those relationships. People really underestimate, you know, kind of the level of trust that you have to have in order to be able to receive Christmas cards every year from this asset. That's incredible.
I trained a lot of men. It was just never an issue. It was only an issue in the minds of the men that I worked with at CIA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People ask me, so how is it there now? And I don't know. I'm going to do a talk, I think, in a couple of weeks. And I may be talking with Gina Haspel, I hope. Because that's like, do you have a minute? Because I want to sit down with her separately and say, so how is that? How is that now?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wish I could be a fly on the wall in that conversation. That would be interesting to engage in. Shifting over to the disguise part of your career and your expertise. So one thing that I was fascinated about when I was reading the book was just your quick ability to assimilate to whatever country that you were in, the culture, making sure that we de-Americanize the officers that we're putting in the field. What was your approach to doing this? How were you able to, you know, say they send you to a country you've never been to, a culture that you've never really experienced, you have some expertise in? What questions did you ask yourself first, and how did you implement that in your disguises?
It was all over the place. The first time I went to Latin America, I'd never traveled down there before. I basically knew nothing. And I was going to be working with a group of men who were local. And I had to disguise them so they wouldn't be recognized in their local city. So the first one I met, he had on this really interesting hat. And I said, what is that hat? What is your hat? He said, I'm from this village up over here. And we all wear this hat. This is our hat. Everybody knows us because this is our hat. They can see us from a distance. It turns out if you're in India and you're talking to some guy out in the Rajasthan desert, truly the middle of nowhere, and he would have a turban on, I'd say, that's a really interesting turban. And I see that you wrap it differently than I've ever seen. Oh yeah, he'd say, that's my village. We all wrap it that way. Fabric changes, not a lot, but that's how we wear our turbans. And when you're traveling around, if you start paying attention, it all becomes local and they know each other. So if you're trying to insert somebody into that thing, they better have on the right hat or the right turban or the right fabric in the turban. So you develop an eye for those kinds of details. But it's not just that. It's when I was disguising our people, they thought that they were going to walk out with a mustache and a wig. By the way, men don't want to wear wigs. And I'm disguising almost totally men, very seldom a female, almost always a man. So maybe it wasn't a wig. Maybe we didn't do a wig. Maybe we just completely restyled a person. We would invent a character. It's not just your face at all. It's everything about you. And your face is a piece of that. So I just had a fellow come into the Spy Museum last week. He was a reporter. He said, how would you disguise me? And I said, well, just standing here, you know, you have a very quiet look. So I would make you a little louder. So your sandy hair, I would make it really dark. Your eyebrows, which I can barely see, I would dye them. I would put heavy rimmed glasses on you. I would put a hair gel on your hair and just slick it back. I would open your shirt a couple of buttons. I'd have some junky chain that you wear. Add a tattoo if you can, you know, they're everywhere. You can do that. I just went down him. I said, oh, and slap on some really noisy cologne and remove your wedding ring because it leaves that mark on your finger, that white place, and see what happens. I gave him those ideas. So he sent me, this is a British reporter. He just sent me a report this morning. He said, so I have a friend here. He said, I arranged to meet her in a bar. He said, she knows me very well. I was standing at the door kind of waiting for her, sort of just hanging out there. He said she walked by me and it was such a strange feeling. He said, then she walked by me again and I said something to her. He said, I think she thought I was a worker down in the docks or something. But he said something to her she looked in my eyes and she recognized me, but not until then. So he all by himself, he created this character and discovered that it's a very powerful thing to be invisible, to be hiding in plain sight and no one can see you. So that was fun.
And that's really like fascinating. You mentioned the Spy Museum, and I think something that stood out to me from some of this conversation was in the Spy Museum, there's a little exhibit on someone named Noor Inayat Khan, who was this South Asian, British resistant agent in France during World War II. And there's a little part of that exhibit where you're sort of comparing the French style of dress to the British style of dress and certain mannerisms, I think, that the French do and the British do that could be a dead giveaway if you're in the opposite country. And there's a little interactive where it's like, hey, like if you drink tea this way, if you use this type of teacup, you know, that is a giveaway. And, you know, Noor Inayat Khan, you know, had a very powerful story. But I think that just came into my head, you know, as soon as you were, you know, talking about, I think part of the building of the character itself versus just a disguise.
There was a movie, I think it was called Inglourious Beth.
Oh my gosh, I just Googled it because I was going to bring it up. Remember yes, that, when they do the scene? Three fingers. Yeah, when they discover him because he put up his three fingers like this instead of like this.
Everyone in the room died.
Inglourious Bastards, by the way, by Quentin Tarantino is what we're talking about.
Oh, what a, you know, it was an interesting movie, but that moment, that was, anyone who sees that will always remember it. But it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. It's so easy to give yourself away. A lot of Americans traveling overseas want to know, they want me to know and tell them, how does everybody know we're American? I mean, what is it? They don't necessarily hear us talking, but they just kind of see us and they know we're American. And so there's just a litany of how they see us, how they know who we are. But they do, no matter what country you're in, they can spot Americans. Unless, of course, you want to negate all of that and be anonymous. But I was in Paris with my son and my husband and my son's girlfriend. And then they were going to walk across the bridges, go over to the left bank. And I said, be careful on the bridges because they're choke points. And there are all these people that are up to no good there. And they're looking for Americans because we fall for this stuff right and left. There are little girls who walk up to you and say, I found this gold ring. Is this your ring, sir? No, it's not my ring. Could you help me find who? And they're setting you up to be pickpocketed. I mean, there's the woman with the baby who walks up and she's, you grab that baby because you know she's going to drop it. If you don't, you grab it, they're going to pickpocket you. So my son, who thought he looked very European, and he put his wallet inside his new leather jacket in a zip, it was zippered. And he and his beautiful girlfriend, if they drew attention, I think because of her, they're going across the bridge. And all of a sudden, this group of young men with clipboards, this is new. They all got around them. They said, we're doing a survey. We're doing a survey of my son.
I got caught to that trick, by the way, in Paris.
Yeah, you did?
I did. I got caught to it. The clipboard with the survey and so on.
This is the first that we had seen it. So by the time they shoot him off and got, they actually had unzipped the thing and they took his money. You're the only other person that I've met so far who had that same thing happen.
Luckily, they didn't steal the wallet, but they stole some cash.
We had rented an apartment in Paris. And when I took the key back, this nice young man gave him the key. And I said, what would you do in that situation? I mean, how would you end that situation? He said, simple. He said, because I'm French. He said, I would turn to them and I would say the equivalent of F off. And I would say it very loud and they would F off. I said, well, I'll tell my son in case it happens again.
So, you know, Jonna, and, you know, I wish I had had this conversation before I went to Paris in 2018 with you, because that would have helped me save a couple of euros. But, you know, when we talk about, you mentioned earlier, you know, how sometimes you'd copy Hollywood, perhaps sometimes Hollywood copied you. I'm sort of curious, and we've talked about this on a prior episode, and I think this is one of your great stories, but the face masks, I think. We see Mission Impossible, we see Tom Cruise peel off the face, and there's a famous photo, I think, of you in the Oval Office with President Bush. Could you sort of share a bit about, you know, how that sort of parallels, I think, what we see in Hollywood as far as you can?
Well, what you see in Hollywood is so impressive. It really is. But it's fake because that's what they do. They have lights and cameras and they can keep taking retakes until they get it where it looks good. A lot of it is CGI. And with masks, almost all of it is CGI. So well done that you can't see it. We started working with Hollywood, making stunt double masks. They were making stunt double masks. We used those masks for some scenarios. If we're in a car, if we're going to be moving, if we're meeting with someone, and you don't want two different races. If you're in South Africa, two different races stopped in a car would draw attention. So somebody would change their ethnicity. It's only so far you can go with double masks. Then we had half masks that looked a lot like you. The top half is a mask. The bottom half is a mustache and a beard attached to the mask. It just goes on. It's really easy. That's also very, very useful. But you can't have a long conversation wearing that. What we ended up taking to the White House was a full face animated mask that fit so perfectly, just fit you, no one else, that you could have a conversation and you could brief a president of the United States in somebody else's face and he would not know until you told him that I'm wearing a disguise and now I'm going to take it off. And you start to do the Tom Cruise peel, which, by the way, should be renamed. And he said, hold on, stop, what, wait. And he got up, this is the president of the United States, and he's walking around and he doesn't even know what he's looking for. I didn't say I'm going to take off a mask. I didn't say I'm wearing a mask. I said, I'm just going to show you. So he couldn't, he's probably looking for lines. Like, where does it stop? Is it a fake nose? What's she wearing? He sat down and he said, okay, take it off. So I took it off. And he really liked it. I mean, he did. He was all sparkly. I've never seen that man so. I always thought he kind of had a flat demeanor. I mean, there was no sparkle in George H.W. Bush, but he kind of sparkled that day. He liked it very much. And Brent Scowcroft was there, and Bob Gates was there, and John Sununu was there, and Bill Webster, who was the head of the CIA at the time. He was my plus one. Maybe I was his plus one. I'm not sure, but I went with him. I was his date. It was great. That was when we first invented that. That was one of the first times that we used it. It was a program we'd worked on for 10 years, and it sent us off in a wonderful new direction with the capability, because with the capability to do all kinds of mischief and be safe. We could actually create a double. We can make a double of anybody. And if you can do that, well, then you can go on stage in Hollywood, because that's what the magicians are doing. And that's how they're blowing your mind with moving the Statue of Liberty or all those things they do. It was just a new beginning. It was a big deal. But, you know, all these years I've been retired, I didn't talk about masks for years and years and years and years. Finally, I understood that we could talk about them. So that nobody has a heart attack anywhere, like I'm giving away state secrets. What it tells me, the fact that we can discuss masks, is that we probably aren't using either those same masks, or we're using them in a different way, or I don't know. But what I'm talking about is clearly not classified anymore.
Yeah, and that kind of leads, I did have some questions, but it segues a bit into what's going on today. So we're not revealing any state secrets or anything, but I was interested in, especially with, you know, all those innovative technologies, mainly what I'm thinking of is biometrics. How is the art of disguise, or how do you perceive it to have changed just to meet the needs of operating in hostile countries?
Well, you know, it will have changed. It won't have died, because, I mean, these we are always going to be involved in human intelligence. There can be all kinds of technology supporting us, or technology ahead of us that are a threat to what we're doing. But you can't take the human part out of the intelligence collection business. At the end of the day, somebody somewhere has information for us, and to pass it to us, they need a willing co-conspirator. That's simply how it works. I'm not sure what disguise looks like now. I think the digital piece of what you need to present when you pass through all kinds of obstacles, that's a consideration. But someone somewhere in Langley, maybe there's a huge new building being built somewhere where they handle identity. What happens with your identity in this technological world that we're in right now? We discovered over the years, over and over, that what would emerge as a threat to us could become something useful to us that we could present back to our opposition. You might be able to take your technological threat and use it to conceal what you were really doing. I don't know. I don't have a need to know, and they're not about to tell me. I'm dying to know. So if you hear anything, you can call me.
So, Jonna, I mean, you know, this is a very dangerous world. It's a very dangerous field, especially for the folks who are donning those disguises. I mean, what were the contingency plans for any disguises that failed?
You know, the contingency plans, just say for masks, First of all, they had to go on. You had to be able to put one on in a dark parked car without a mirror, without lights, without anyone saying it's on right. It had to go on, and you had to, there were like registration points, and you had to say, okay, it's on, it's good, get out of the car. If somebody came after you for any reason, that mask, the other design specification was it had to come off just as fast, and it had to crumple down to almost nothing. Or you could like put it under your arm. What mask? You know, there's no disguise. There's no crumbs of it lying around. There's one man I've talked to occasionally who had on a mask in Moscow. Then there was some hostile pursuit. He took it off and he put it under a rock, a big rock. He lived there, so he knew what he was doing. And I asked him if he ever went to get it. He said he did not. He said, in fact, what they have done is they built a high rise on that plot of land. He's pretty sure it's, you know, it's there. But even if they ever found it, they couldn't trace it back to anybody. With wigs and the rest of it, I don't know of a disguise failing. I don't have a scenario where someone came to me and said, oh, you know, they they knew I had on a wig or whatever. I just don't have any stories to give you on that. There were probably incidents, but the disguises were tailored to the scenarios that people were gonna wear them in. If it was if it was just a wig and a pair of glasses, you might do something like that, where maybe the person you're meeting with knows you have on a disguise, but the person you're worried about is your neighbor from downtown Arlington, who's in Paris on vacation, walks by and says, "Oh, you know, Bill," but you're not Bill now. So you were always looking at what's the scenario, what is the purpose of this disguise, and then we build them to those specifications.
I mean, this may be, I don't know if you can necessarily share all this information, but I mean, like, were people ever caught, I'd say. And I mean, like, this also may be a dumb question, but like, what happened when people were caught?
We always use Moscow as the example, because that was the hardest place. People that were picked up in Moscow would be taken to a government installation, would be given one phone call, because there was a protocol. They could call their embassy, and the duty security officer would get in his car and start heading over. They would they could take everything you had. They could put it out on the table. What is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? They'd keep you for a couple of hours interrogating you in a kind of a harsh way. But they would basically, now all of our people, not all of our people, most of our people had official passports, had official paperwork. The embassy would send someone to vouch for them. So it wasn't like they were picking up people on the street that didn't have some kind of bona fides that they could present.
Were our adversaries using the same or similar tactics in terms of the art of disguise at that time? Or was it pretty unique too?
It was unique to us in Moscow. That was the center of the universe, where everything was so hard to collect the information that we needed. When the KGB, when they come to the United States, they don't need to wear masks. The FBI, who is in charge of them, put that in quotes, they don't follow them. They don't put blanket surveillance on them. In Moscow, every officer that left that embassy had blanket surveillance. They had dedicated teams that knew where you lived and where you usually went on Tuesdays. But they'd follow you to that place on Tuesday, and they'd sit and wait for you to come out, and they'd follow you back. It was we said it was like a smothering embrace. You were not gonna have a conversation with one of their citizens. You were not gonna have an opportunity to do any productive work while you were in Moscow. That was their goal. And we don't treat it that way here at all. Nobody else has a Hollywood, where we leaned heavily on Hollywood and on the magic community as well. Those were two areas of expertise that we were lucky to have at our disposal.
So in doing this work, I mean, obviously we just sort of alluded to the fact that this is sort of like life and death for, you know, those operatives, those agents, those who are donning the disguises and the masks and et cetera. So how did you sort of cope with the gravity of that role in ensuring the safety of your team, in ensuring the safety of those folks who are working with? You mentioned a little bit earlier about some of those soft skills, about, you know, actually asking them about their family, their kids, building those relationships. But also at that point, you know, there's also almost this sort of emotional relationship that you can sometimes develop, like where you care about your agents. But I mean, how do you balance all of that out sometimes in this world?
That's an interesting question. In the Moscow Rules, that was the book that came out before this last book, In True Face, we added a rule. We had the list of rules had been written before. Now I have to go back. The Moscow Rules were rules of engagement. We didn't invent them. We just wrote them down. And this was mostly Tony Mendez's project. Everybody at CIA who'd served out there, they knew the rules, but we just wrote them down. There were like 41 of them. And we added rule 42, which was never fall in love with your agent. And we didn't mean romantic love. We meant just what you're asking about. don't get too close. This is a professional relationship. It's dicey because it was a little more than a professional relationship. There was this trust, especially, you know, on their part, that we would protect them. And we were 100% in that agreement. But if something went badly, and it did sometimes, you had to professionally just kind of step back and keep moving on. I mean, if we could go in and exfiltrate somebody, if we knew something was going wrong, oh boy, we would go get them and we would go get their families and we would do everything possible. But sometimes there wasn't an opportunity to do anything. There was one agent named Trigon who we were all attached to this man, and they arrested him and he didn't make it. And it was just the CIA, the people that knew about that case, it was like we had all lost a dear relative. But the rule was almost like with your doctor or your dentist. I love my doctor. I don't love my dentist, but I like him a lot. But it's you can't actually develop a personal relationship, or then it starts clouding things, right? You have to keep it a professional relationship. And that was the dilemma with some of these people.
Is that clear? Or how do officers make that clear when recruiting these assets? Like, this is a strictly professional relationship. I mean, we're maybe going into something that you learn on the farm, but
I think it's understood. I think it's what the foreign assets want. They want to feel that they're working with a group of people who will break every rule if they have to protect them. I don't think they're expecting to find best friends or anything. I don't think they're looking for that kind of relationship. It's outside of friendship. It is professional, but it is profound. The people that will take those risks. I know when I was working in photo operations, and we had this little tiny camera that was in a fountain pen. It had a little piece of film. We gave it to our very, very best people, the ones who had access, the ones that could walk up to Putin's desk and stand there and talk to him with their pen, taking notes. And he'd turn his head to do something, and they could just take a picture of that agenda or the minutes and keep writing notes. Whenever I got a piece of that film and I'm in the dark room, I would sit there and I would just start sweating, because this guy, whoever he was, I didn't even always know who it was, had risked his life. And, you know, you cannot screw up that film. You cannot screw up that film. There was one time I was in, can I say where I was? I don't know if I can say. I can't say where I was, but I was in an embassy, and the embassy was attacked by guys with guns, bunches of them. I was visiting. I was in the dark room in the embassy with the door closed, locked. I'm developing that film. I kept hearing these muffled. They forgot that I was in there, and I had no idea what was going on outside. And when I finished that film, because you can't stop in the middle, and I came out, I looked out the window. There were all these military people with guns. You know, you can't stop.
That's terrifying, to be honest.
It was terrifying. The guy that was really terrified was the security officer who forgot I was in that room.
Hopefully that situation was resolved by the time you got outside of the room.
I think I suggested that they put a buzzer. But even if there had been a buzzer, I still couldn't have come out.
And it was also important to, you know, not lose track of the photographs that you were developing, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gold. The photos out of those pens were solid gold. Intelligence.
So, Jonna, I mean, you know, In writing this book, you know, to communicate, you know, a lot of your life, your work, the importance of this work to the general public, I mean, what are some of the biggest myths that you see around your work that the general public may believe that you try to dispel inside your book?
Well, as silly as it sounds, I was on a treadmill not long ago, and I kind of knew the woman next to me, and she asked me, We're just chatting, talking. I said something about I'm writing a book. What about? I said, CIA, I worked there. She said, with all those assassins and murderers? And I thought, oh, this is why I'm writing the book. To try, yeah, my idea about a book, it started out, it was just a memoir, and there was COVID. It was that simple. What am I going to do? I can't do any more jigsaw puzzles. I'll just start writing this story of what it was like working. And the book changed when I was writing it. It my memoir, and then turned into there were other women there. About them, it went to Michelle Obama and my mother, but women outside of the agency, and kind of were reflecting the American workplace. And women have been discriminated against in the workplace forever. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. That's why it's dedicated to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, among others, and Eloise Page. So it became something that I didn't mean to write, but it was kind of organic. It was growing in that direction. People don't realize, how would they know? A lot of the foreign people, the foreign assets that work for us, volunteer to work for us. And it's hard for them to get our attention sometimes, because we think, oh, the KGB is sending them, they're double agents or something. And you have to really work hard to get our attention. They don't always work for money. Money is not typically high on their list. So that takes you to why do people spy? What causes people to betray their country? And it depends on the nationality. For Americans, they do it for money. People like Alder James, they get in a bind. Bob Hansen, get in a bind. They need some money. They will sell secrets. And look at a lot of the Russians that come to us. Ideology is the thing that very often brings them to us. And it doesn't have to be current. Stalin left a permanent stain on the Soviet Union. People's families, they go back a generation, two generations. One of our best assets was working for us. He was a military man, and he knew that he could never get promoted again because his father had been with the Bolsheviks during that revolution. And there's a mark in his file, in his military file, he could never get promoted any further than where he was. He said, well, the hell with this. And he came to work for us. A lot of interesting stories, ideological, those stories. Some people spy for ego, people that get passed over for a promotion, people that think that they're not recognized for how skilled they are and how wonderful they are, people who are dissatisfied in their workplace. So they come to us for different reasons. The people that we're looking for, we get a list every year, a program from Washington, D.C. that says, this is what we want to know. Nuclear programs in these countries. Do you know anybody? Can you find somebody in those programs? We want to know. Let's just talk Iran. How are they doing? Where are they in that process? If you can find people who can give us that information, we'd like to know it. We don't just go out and recruit people in bars. We go specifically looking for people who would have knowledge on these specific topics that the United States government is trying to deal with. I mean, our job is to collect that intelligence and get it back to our policymakers on the plans and intentions of these foreign countries. It's just so simple. That's all it is. What are they going to do? So think right now, what are they going to do? What's Israel going to do? Today, what's Iran getting ready to do? Are they going to, you know, it's really dangerous. What are the Russians going to do next? Where are they going to land in some of these conflicts? That's what they need to know so they can make smart decisions. If you look at it that way, I think it makes a lot more sense that you have to have an intelligence organization that can go try and find out the answers to those questions. We were the last ones to form an intelligence organization. And that was after Pearl Harbor. Everybody else was up and running. The French, the Russians, everybody else had an intelligence organization but us. So we were late to the party, but we've done pretty well along the way.
We have done pretty well. So many accomplishments and so many things still yet to do. I mean, just talking about Israel, Iran, so many conflicts that are happening, a possible conflict in the Indo-Pacific. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But I mean, just to wrap us up here, what other work needs to be done to close this divide between the public's understanding of what it means to work, you know, in with government, working in national security issues? How are we going to convince people like your treadmill friend that this work is honorable?
You know, the American public, maybe it's broader than that, has become so distrustful of everything. And this whole idea of the truth and where is the truth and what is the truth and whose truth? Whose truth do you believe? That there are like multiple versions of different scenarios. That's larger than the intelligence dilemma of having secret information and then trying to convince people that we know what we know, but we can't tell them what we know. It's a kettle of worms. Am I mixing more metaphors? It's a kettle of worms.
A kettle is like a pot. It's okay. Can. It's a can of worms.
I hope we have an editor who can just take that out. It's larger than the intelligence thing, but certainly the intelligence community is caught up in that. I'm going to an event in a week where Avril Haines, who's the DNI, she's the head of the whole thing, is going to be speaking. And I'll be really, really interested to see if she can come up with some ideas on where we can head in that regard. It's an issue. Everyone has access to so much information today, and the dilemma is to pick and choose your information, right? Your truth. And it starts with what cable news do you watch? I get a paper newspaper. What newspaper do you pay attention to? You have to find your sources, and we're not all going to the same place. We're getting different stories.
Yeah. You just have to be open-minded about everything.
I think you do. And I think you can't just pick and choose. It's not just America either. It's around the world. This is going on.
No, absolutely. Well, Jonna, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today on The Burn Bag. We know you've had a crazy but fantastic book tour. And I'm so glad to see the book really pick up steam in the mainstream, you know, outside of our national security and foreign policy circles. It's been awesome to see. Thank you for your service to our country as well. You know, you did a lot of good work in protecting our national security and advancing it as well. But, you know, Jonna, your book, In True Phase, is a fantastic read to our audience. I suggest you all go pick it up. We'll have a link to the book on Amazon as well. If you ever visit the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., it's just by the wharf, you'll see and hear Jonna as she actually talks about some of this work too. But for now, thank you so much for joining me here today.
It's a pleasure. It was actually really a pleasure. You two were fun to talk to. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was inspired, Jonna. So just know it was a pleasure talking to you on my end.